All right, so today we're in Love and Torah, part 51. And we're going to continue here in the book of James. Of course, some of you are figuring out that James is getting closer to Revelation. I must be getting close to the end of this. I am. I mean, certainly I could have ended at any point. We've said plenty, but there's so many more things still, especially here in James, that I think are vital to our understanding the second of the two great commands. All right, so love in Torah has always been about the connection between love and his instruction. And Yeshua gave us the two great commands, to love him, to love our Creator, and to love each other, okay? And so the second part of that is what we've been focused on now for the last 20 weeks or so, whatever it's been. And that's the harder part of this. And we're going to cover some things today that I think will help us understand why we struggle and where we struggle in James 3 and in James 4, if we get there today. But I think they're vital. I wouldn't want to leave them out. I mean, that's one of the things that I like about being in charge, so to speak, so I don't have anybody trying to tell me, look, I need you to do this or that or whatever. I can take this as slow and get as deep and not leave something out as I want to, and that's great. I used to have the pressure that I thought I imposed on myself to try to do things one part, just do a whole teaching, and you miss so much. There's just too much material to cover in one teaching. And so I hope you appreciate, you know, yes, this is 51 of them, but this topic is that involved and has that much to it and has that many pieces to it and issues that really I would not be helping you as much by just giving you an overview, really, if I did this in one or two parts. It would just be barely touching any of it. But to see how many places in Scripture this is covered, to see how much it's an issue everywhere is so valuable, to see that Abba's talking about it everywhere. And then also to go slow enough to break down verses and make sure we're really understanding and getting the impact. And so I really, you know, I want to just encourage everybody, because I know sometimes people who are new, especially, like, part 50, what? Well, I don't think I've bored anybody to death yet, okay? And I don't think I've worn you out and said, well, he's already beaten this thing to death, although some people are saying that, but they're not listening if they are. Because every part's been different and unique to enough of a degree to cover some aspect that you needed to hear. All right, so I just want to make sure that I throw that out there. And not that anybody's been complaining, but I feel like sometimes it's important to, you know, just kind of cover and understand why we do it this way. All right, Yaakov chapter 3. Now remember, the context of all of this James has been talking about has been in the context of the verse 12 of chapter 1, which is that we shall receive the crown of life that was promised to those if we love him, right? To those who love him. There's a crown of life being offered and available to those who love him. And in his instructions, he not only instructs us on how to love him specifically, but he also instructs us on how to love each other, which is also, because loving him is expressed through trusting obedience, when we love each other the way he expresses instructions in, we're also loving him. So all of it is really the first great command, that we are to love him with all our might, being, strength, etc. And part of the way we express that is also by the way we treat each other, the way we love each other. Because he instructs a lot about how we love each other and how we're to treat each other. And by the way, if you notice in the apostolic writings, this is covered way more than loving Elohim directly necessarily, because their writings are like counselings. Like counseling the people that they've been given, or counseling the dispersion, which we see is what James is talking about. He's giving counsel to the dispersion. He says, look, I know you guys have issues, and your biggest issue is how you treat each other. Because that's where we have our fighting and our strife and all these other things. And so he wants to address that here, because he wants us to understand that there's a crown of life waiting for those who love him. So we get to chapter 3. And of course, in chapter 2, we talked about how belief is expressed through actions, through works, through what we do. That belief is an action. It's not an idea or a concept. It's an action. We do because we believe. And we don't do because of how we believe. You know, those who struggle with Torah observance struggle because they have beliefs that are in conflict with the Torah instruction. And so they only do what they believe. Now, you don't have to believe from an understanding point of view. In other words, you don't have to understand every detail to do. You just have to believe that if he said it, it's right to do, and we need to do it. That's where the belief comes in. So the action comes out of that. We have the example that is used in chapter 2 of Abraham. I doubt, I don't want to say definitively, but I doubt that he actually understood the whole Akedah issue, the offering of Isaac. But what he knew is that he believed that he was supposed to do whatever Yahweh said, and he trusted that that would be for the good. Whether he understood why, and I doubt very much he did, because I don't know how he could have understood. And plus, it really wouldn't have been the test that it was if he understood. What he understood was Yahweh said it. And that's what we need to understand, okay? And Yahweh doesn't just say things like that. He says, I want you to love your neighbor as yourself. I want you to love each other. And so this is also part of his love language. He's instructing us. We call them commandments. The reason they're commandments is because they are in the imperative. He's expecting you to do it. They're not suggestions. He didn't give us the 10 suggestions or the 613 suggestions or recommendations. They're commandments. He's expecting covenanted people to do them. He's not expecting everybody to do them. Not until he opens up their understanding of covenant and they can make the choice to covenant or not. This is what Moses is telling us when he gives the instructions, and at the end of Deuteronomy, he says, look, I've laid before you blessing and curse, life and death, choose life. So then we get to chapter 3. Not many, verse 1, not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, knowing that we shall receive a greater judgment. Please meditate on that verse the next time you go to straighten people out, teach them something, or tell them how wrong they are, and then you know, you're now in a teaching position or instructing position. This is coming from the head apostle at that time, Yaakov, and he's saying, not many of you should become teachers. And you should know that there's a greater judgment on the teacher because you're now responsible if people do what you said or started understanding things the way you instructed them and you happen to be wrong, you're now going to get a greater judgment. So before you jump out there and start correcting a lot of people, understand that you may be right, you may be wrong. We're not trying to quote from Billy Joel here, but I haven't given you guys a song reference in too long, okay? But the thing is, you, whether you're right or wrong, the fact that you could be wrong is very much a risk you should not want to just take, just put yourself in that position. And he's giving that warning very strongly. He said, look, not many of you should become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a greater judgment. For we all stumble in many things, many matters. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man or man filled with integrity, able also to bridle the entire body. So he's talking about the fact that we all stumble. It's not just in our thoughts, in our actions, all these things. We do have issues from time to time, all fall short. He says, but if you can get to the point where you have integrity, where you're filled with tamim, where you're this idea of he is a perfect man, there's this bridling of the body. And what is he talking about bridling? That's the bridle is what you put in a horse to get it to go where you want it to go. All right? It goes in the mouth, and when you pull on it, it hurts. And it's the way that if the horse is going away, you don't want it, you pull on that, and you're like, no, don't go that way. And then you let it off a little bit when he's doing it right, and he's okay. And so it helps to get the body, or the horse in this case, to go in the direction it's supposed to go. Stop when it's supposed to stop, start when it's supposed to start, turn when it's supposed to turn. But you are guiding that body. But he's telling you, look, we all stumble in many things, but if you don't stumble in the word, what's the word? The Torah, the truth, Yeshua. Okay? If you don't stumble in the word, this is showing that you are able to bridle the entire body. So it's not saying that just the word Sabbath keeping or the word kosher eating or the word feast keeping or the word in the context of any one thing. He's talking if you don't stumble in the word in its entirety, to do so, you have to bridle the entire body. Because the word covers everything you do and how you do it and the way we treat each other and the way we treat our Elohim. And we need to bridle ourselves. I would say that in my studies of late, and not just of late, but more of late, it keeps coming up, a reminder that our biggest challenge from a motivational, personal development, growth, whatever you want to call it, is not wanting the right things or setting and aiming things at a certain level. I mean, that's all important stuff. The biggest problem is bridling. We call that discipline. It takes discipline to accomplish anything challenging. It takes discipline to get to the place where it says endure and receive the crown of life. It takes discipline to endure. It takes discipline to say no to things you should say no to. To say yes to those things you should say yes to do the things you need to do, even and especially when you don't want to, when the desire is not there, or to not do something that you desire really to do, but you know you shouldn't be doing that. And that's this idea of the bridle. I just want to put that in there, that we really have a struggle with discipline, with having that strength to make the body do what you want it to do and not what you don't want. A lot of us have a problem with that, with those things that are of the fleshly pleasures, especially things like foods. Hard to say no, you know, especially if someone brings it out and it's just there. You didn't have to go buy it. Or if you're at somewhere else and somebody's paying for it, you're like, oh, sure, I'll have dessert and I'll eat all that stuff that I know I shouldn't eat or whatever it is. I've watched people with, you know, lactose intolerance issues but I want that cheese. I want that, but, you know, you know better. Or diabetics who are eating all kinds of junk. I mean, you know you shouldn't, but it's so hard to resist these things. Well, guess what? It works in the Torah world too. I mean, I still get questions from people about things on Shabbat they know they can't do and shouldn't do, but they want to do them, so they just ask with just a chance I might say, yes, you can do it. And I actually catch people sometimes and I'll ask the question back to them and say, okay, are you asking because you don't know the answer or because you're hoping you'll get a different one? Because some of the people I know, they're not new, they know the answer, but they're hoping that this might get a dispensation for that. Well, can I just do this if I do it this? No. But if you had discipline, you wouldn't even have asked, you would have known. You'd recognize that it's your desire that's the problem. And we're going to see that continues to be something that comes through. You know, James is talking about the idea of desire. All right, we talk about this in chapter 1. He says in verse 14, says, each one is enticed when he's drawn away by his own desires and trapped. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it has been accomplished, brings forth death. This only happens when you lack discipline. When it's without information, it's not considered the same. In other words, if you didn't know. You didn't know. He's talking about that you were enticed. You can't be enticed unless you knew. Otherwise, it's just something you want and you go and want to do it. But the enticing means, I know I shouldn't, but I want to do it anyway. And it's the desire in you. He didn't say, by the way, notice that Hasatan isn't mentioned anywhere there. It says his own desires trap you. Your own desires trap you. So let's be careful with that. So when he talks about in verse 2 of chapter 3, this idea of bridling, and then we're going to see that really gets developed even more as we talk about what we talk about. He's going to bring it into the focus of our tongue. Verse 3 says, look, we put bits in the mouths of horses for them to obey us, and we turn their bodies. That's why I use the horse example. Look at the ships too. Although they are so big and are driven by strong winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot intends. Same idea as a bridle. So too, verse 5, the tongue is a little member, yet boasts greatly. See how a little fire kindles a great forest. And the tongue is a fire, the world of unrighteousness. Among our members, the tongue is set, the one defiling the entire body and setting on fire the wheel of life. And it is set on fire by Gehenna. So let's just stop there and think about this. So he's trying to say, look, we have desires, chapter 1. We're trying to get to the point where we get this crown of life by demonstrating our love for him. We have a problem with our actions being in line with what we claim is our words about our belief, because those say, here's my belief and have no works. And he says, I'll show you my belief by my works. Then he says, be careful, not many of you should be teachers. And now he's talking about discipline in the tongue. I think he's really talking about those of us that step out in that realm of speaking what we should be keeping our mouth shut. So be careful. It's not just the tongue from the point of view of no context. He first started out about teaching. So let's really be careful that we connect this in the right context. Because a lot of people just start off with, you know, look at the, putting the bits in the horse's mouth and the tongue is bad. And so we always think about what we say. And listen, our mouth is our problem a lot. Okay? And we put our foot in it plenty. And a lot of garbage comes out of it. But I think part of the context here isn't still in the context of teaching. You think you know, and then you start to correct and go in the role of a teacher. You instruct, you guide, you correct. You tell people, oh, that's not the way it is. This is the way it is. And you start straightening people out, etc. He says, be really careful with that. There's a greater judgment. I think we can also take the other full context of many of you end up in trouble with each other because of what you say and how you say it and not thinking before you speak. You know, I knew somebody one time, and I have to admit, being very ADD, he frustrated me a lot. But this gentleman that I knew never said anything without thinking first. And he would literally pause and parse every word before he would speak. And I would sit there waiting for whatever was going to come out. Now, he was a naturopathic doctor, and he was helping me with some health issues I had. This is about 20 years ago. And I sat there in a consultation. Now, he was giving me a free consultation because I was his rabbi at the time. Other people were paying, I don't know how much they were paying, $60, $70 an hour for that. I'm thinking, I would be pulling the words out of his mouth at that price. But I appreciated that he was consciously thinking about everything before he said it. Because I could see that's what he was doing, and then he was very careful about what he said. And most of us just vomit stuff out without any filter, without any thinking. It just comes out. There's no bridling it. There's no restrictor plate. If you want to think from your car people, like you understand, like with NASCAR and stuff. There's nothing to slow that whole deal down. It just flies right out. He says, and the tongue is a fire, and there's a world of unrighteousness that can come out of that. The unbridled tongue is what we're talking about here. So be careful with that, because it does defile the entire body. This one little thing can really defile all kinds of things, you and other people around you. We have a rampant psycho-emotional disease called high susceptibility to the negative influences of other people. I know it's a lot of words, but the body is basically, we would call this SNIOPT, okay? Susceptible to the negative influences of other people. And so if you're going to spew negativity, you have to know there are others that are not just going to understand that you're venting or whatever. They're going to embrace it and go in that same direction that you are. Because they also are not as consciously aware. By the way, I think that's really the biggest problem that all of us have. We are walking in a state that's not consciousness. It's semi-conscious or semi-awake. And what I mean by that is so many things we do are auto-responses. They're triggered responses. They're practiced and rehearsed responses. They're habits. They're ways that we just do and act without really thinking about it. So we're not that conscious of ourselves. We're very conscious a lot about everything else around us and people around us. That we're sort of hyper aware of, and we notice every little thing everybody does and everything bothers us or whatever. But are you aware of yourself? Remember, we've talked about this many times, that to be successful in our relationships, you have to be hyper aware of self and the context of everything going around you situationally. We have a terrible time with situational awareness. You walk into a situation that you're not aware of what the situation is, and you start flying off and don't realize that you've gotten it all wrong. You misread the situation. You had no idea what was really going on. You came in like the bull in the china shop, so to speak, crashing and breaking everything, and we're wrong. And a lot of us have all experienced that. We've done that only to find out you had completely gotten it wrong. You misread the whole situation. I'm going to recommend that to not end up in that place, slow down. Okay, slow down. Not everything in your life, but slow down when you jump into something. Be more reluctant to jump into something. Make sure that you have the right information so that you could even decide whether you should jump into something. Notice I didn't say make sure you have enough information so that you can jump in. You should be making sure you have enough information so that you can make a proper decision whether or not you should be involved. Because there's probably a whole lot of things out there that you're involved in that you have no business and no need to be involved in. And your involvement isn't going to help anything. If anything, it may hinder it. And so, but you're not aware because you just want to jump out there because it's a desire. You got to set something straight, or you don't like it, or that person's wrong, or this thing's not right, or that. Take a breath. Calm down. Sometimes you got to let things be. It may not be your job or your role. But that tongue starts going. And by the way, by tongue will include any form of communication, which means typing on your phone or on your keyboard is the same thing. Any form of communication, we're talking about any kind of, you know, verbal communication, using words to communicate. Let's be really careful with that. Texting, postings, because that stuff, you know, is out there, and you may at some point realize how foolish some of that was, and you can't take it back. I don't care if you delete the post. People involved will have already screenshot it, saved it, or something. It's out there forever. And so you got to be careful with that. That tongue can really be a problem. By tongue, I mean any kind of communication by words. Body language is another issue, but this is all talking about the tongue. So we'll go with communication using words. He says, verse 7, for every kind of bird, every kind of beast and bird, a reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man is able to tame the tongue. It is unruly, evil, filled with deadly poison. Now, let's connect the tongue to where the problem really is. The tongue is the means of communication of the out of the abundance of the heart. The mouth speaks, right? And so that's why he's saying all this. When you just start, you know, speaking out of turn and saying things and everything that the heart is wrong, then you're coming out wrong. Your motivation's often wrong, and that's why you're so quick to jump in. We have to be very, very aware that this is what's causing so much hurt in the body. More often than not, it's because somebody said something, or because somebody didn't say something that maybe they should have said, but just not understanding the whole power of the tongue. You know, I could do a whole teaching just on this, and we could spend, I don't know, weeks and weeks just in Proverbs, how many times the tongue is talked about and the mouth and things that have to do with how we speak and communicate. And the righteous blah, 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 and the foolish blah, blah, blah. It tells you all the time. This is how that all works in terms of the way we use our words and our communication. He says, so no man is able to tame the tongue. So we might as well just give up, right? Because the tongue is not the problem. It results out of the problem, which is out of the heart, which is the heart is not just desire. The heart is thoughts and concepts with emotions attached. Let's remind you again, the definitions I've given you in the past. The mind, we'll call that, or the thinking process is where we think, we have thoughts and ideas. When those ideas and thoughts have emotions attached to them and we hold on to them, we call that the heart. That's where they sit in the heart. We take them into captivity when we first think about them, then we can decide what to attach or not to attach emotionally to them. Problem is, we don't do very much of that filtering. We just think, we get emotional, and it goes into the heart. It becomes part of our feelings about things. Anything that I mention to you, generally speaking, when I say it, a feeling will come up. A weak one, a strong one, depends on what it is. Maybe something you don't feel very strongly about, maybe something you feel very strongly about. But the feeling will trigger. I mentioned something, and that's what's going to come up, because that thought is connected to a feeling. Now, if I mention something you've never thought before or had any feelings about, it won't trigger anything. But if you have any experience with whatever it is I said, it's going to bring out, evoke that emotion that you've connected to the thought. The tongue will then be the process of communicating that feeling. Say, no, you can't tame the tongue. You have to tame the emotional thought, the idea and the emotion that's connected to it. That's where it has to be. And we've talked about that, you know, a tremendous amount. In the heart of the matter, in a lot of these other teachings lately, we've talked about how that whole process works. And what are you thinking? Understanding the thought, emotion, response, action loop, how that plays out. And by the way, it is a loop, because if I think something, feel something about it, then do something because of it, the more I do that, the more it solidifies that thought and emotion. And the more I do it, the more it becomes reflexive instead of something I might think about. Which is why you have a relationship with your spouse, or you had a relationship, say, with a parent, and you knew, we call this pushing a button, right? What is pushing a button? It simply means that an automatic response got triggered to an action or thought or something you experienced that you had an emotional connection already embedded to that thing. You can have it to something that you see. It could be a response to something you smell. It could be something that you experience on any level can trigger a response. It could be a noise or a sound. It will trigger some. And by the way, sometimes it triggers good feelings, certain sounds, certain music, certain smells. It doesn't matter. You experience something and it will get whatever you've already placed in there. The emotion will come out. There's an emotion connected. And he's saying that beware that ultimately then something comes out of your mouth. And you can't bridle the tongue. You have to bridle further downstream at the source. And that's really the point I want to make sure we get here. To bridle the tongue, you can't do it. Because the tongue is just a physical mechanism of words coming out of your mouth that came from somewhere. The tongue didn't produce the idea, the concept, or the words. The tongue is just vocalizing them. Your mouth is coming out of your mouth. But your mouth is just a way to get it out of your heart, out in the public area for somebody to hear. He says, listen, this is verse 9 now. Okay? Remember he said in verse 8, but no man's able to tame it. It is unruly, evil, filled with deadly poison. With it we bless our Elohim and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the likeness of Elohim. So the tongue can do all kinds of things, good and evil. So we do the same thing. It's kind of like, you know, people have used the line, we use these metaphors like, you know, somebody says something that you think is inappropriate, you go, and you kiss your mother with that mouth. Right? You've all heard that phrase. Yep. The same mouth that says good things also says bad things. The same that blesses, the same can curse. The problem is, do you have it bridled? And you have to do the bridling deeper down into the heart where the thoughts and the emotions are. Okay. He says, with it we bless our Elohim and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the likeness of Elohim. Out of the same mouth proceed blessings and cursing. My brothers, this should not be so. This should not be so. Does the fountain send forth the sweet and the bitter from the same opening? No. My brothers, is a fig tree able to bear olives or a grapevine figs? So neither is a fountain able to make salt and sweet water. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by his good behavior his works in meekness of wisdom. The meekness here is humility, okay? So just, it's maybe an easier word for you to understand. Okay, so he's saying, look, you can't claim and do one thing and the other thing also and think that that works. It doesn't work. This is called hypocrisy. So, okay, I know over time I've told you that there's a battle in the book from the beginning to the end between, you know, belief and trust versus doubt and fear. There's another battle going on utilizing those things to motivate the humility and integrity versus hypocrisy. That is our battle of the fruit of the fear and doubt versus the belief and trust. It comes out with a problem with either integrity or hypocrisy. And he's saying, look, if you have both of these things coming out of the same place, we're in hypocrisy. There's no integrity there. And remember, the goal here, he was saying earlier, was if anyone does not stumble in word, verse 2, he is a perfect man filled with integrity because he's not stumbling and having good and evil, blessing and curse coming out of the same place. This is why I've told you over and over again that even if you're right technically about something and you go about it in a way that's not the fruit of the Ruach, okay, technically, let's say you're right about an issue of Torah, but you go and punch me in the mouth with it, and you're not patient, and you're not loving, and you're not gentle, and you're not kind, then you're still wrong. Because you can't be right and wrong at the same time. Right and wrong is wrong. Wrong and wrong is wrong. The only way to be right is right and right. Okay? Let's understand that. You can't be right and wrong. That's still wrong. And own that. That's what he's talking about here in chapter 3. He's saying, look, you can't get olives off of a fig tree. You're not going to grow figs on a grapevine. Each thing's going to produce what it produces. You're going to get olives from an olive tree. You're going to get figs from a fig tree. You're not going to get the other things. You're not going to get sweet and salty water out of the same spring. You're going to get one or the other. Let's continue. He says, who is wise and understanding among you? In other words, are you wise and understanding what I'm talking about here? Now, in asking this, he's not just asking, are you, you know, mentally capable, intellectually capable of understanding? But are you open enough from your delusion bubble being popped, etc., that you're actually able to receive something that may not go in line with how you've always thought it to be? And the wise and understanding, where does wisdom come from? The fear of Yahweh. Where does understanding come from? The fear of Yahweh. So it's a vertical structure thing. And what James is saying here is, can you receive from me as your vertical authority? I'm sharing stuff with you. I am in a higher position authority-wise. I am a teacher. I have a responsibility for you. Are you wise in understanding? Can you receive from me? Because that's part of the whole vertical there. Because I'm trying to tell you guys why you guys have problems. And chapter 4 is going to start off with where do fightings and strivings come from among you? That's chapter 4. We're going to get there in a minute. But he's saying, I understand you guys have issues. You fight, you strive, you have contention. And where does it come from? Well, he's saying, if you're wise and understanding, you can receive this from me. Because if you're receiving it from me, you know that it's not coming from me, it's coming from above. Now let's continue. He says, those who are wise and understanding, let him show by his good behavior his works in humility of wisdom. In other words, you're going to do these things in the fear of Yahweh. With a proper, and if you don't understand what the fear of Yahweh is, listen to the teaching. It's to be simple, it's a proper fear, reverence, and awe. Highest level of respect you could have is that's what it means by that fear. The fear to let down, to disappoint. The fear of having him look at you and look down at you with his head down, shaking his head saying, I can't believe you just did that. Why would you do that? I told you not to. I've encouraged you not to. I've commanded you not to. You did it anyway. that fear of that look. And so he's saying, do you have the wisdom and the understanding to go forward and do good behavior through good works in humility of wisdom? He says, but if you have bitter jealousy and self-seeking in your heart, okay, do not boast against and lie against the truth. So he's saying that this is the source. The heart is where the problem is. If there's bitter jealousy and self-seeking in there, guess what's going to come out of your mouth? Things that shouldn't. He's saying, be careful. If you have bitter jealousy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast against and lie against the truth. In other words, you're then going to be back to verse 1, teaching or instructing or stepping up in a place where you're going to be saying things in a boastful, proud, ego-driven way, things that are actually not going to be in line with the truth. What's the truth? Yeshua, the Torah, the Word. So be careful with that. But some of you are thinking that, oh, but I'm trying to teach and show the truth. But what if you're wrong and don't understand it as well as you think you do? And don't tell me those of you that are sharing with people didn't share with people back in the day. You didn't share with people back in the day when you were in Christianity and you had all these things sideways and inside out. So you know you've been pretty bold before and been wrong. And he's trying to say, let's not keep doing that. Let's not keep going out there, spewing out our mouths, all out of our jealousy and self-seeking. Self-seeking meaning, I want to feel good like I know, and I want you to know that I know. And I want to elevate myself by basically pushing you down. You don't think of this consciously, but you do this. You're getting your self-worth out of pushing down or showing up or shaming somebody else. You want to see, I'm so smart, you're wrong, I'm right, I need to show you. And that's a whole different place to be. And I don't play that game. I know people accuse me of everything under the sun. I don't play the game. If you're sitting with me in counseling and you don't want to listen, I won't counsel you. And that's okay, I don't need to counsel, you don't need to listen. But I'm not going to argue with you and tell you how wrong you are. I'll just say, if you're coming to me, then you should be ready to listen. That's Deuteronomy 17, and we talked about that in the Torah portion last week. Okay? So, I won't do this, though, and just start badgering and saying, but you're... No, if you're wrong, I'll tell you, look, I think you're wrong. You need to listen. You don't want to listen? Fine. Go do what you need to do. There's no reason to bang heads and fight about it. But see, you won't do that. You'll find people that are wrong, and you're going to keep beating on them until they see you're right. Because you're almost more concerned with them knowing you're right than them actually knowing they're wrong. And it irritates you that they don't see that you're right. And you want to beat on them. He says, this is not, listen, we're going to get into this whole above and below thing that I've talked about so much. This is not wisdom coming down from above. But it is earthly, unspiritual, demonic, worldly. Go back and listen to Peace in a World Not His and Darkness and Light. I talk a lot about the above and the below. I think mostly in Darkness and Light, I covered that quite a bit. I'm looking over at Mark because I know he listened to that a lot. The above and the below, I covered that a lot in Darkness and Light? Yes, okay. All right, well, I know he's been listening to it lately. Understand, everything that's good and right comes from the above. The above is giving into the below these things. Light is coming into the darkness. The below is darkness, the above is light. The above is heaven, Yahweh's throne, all of the good things that are up there in the above. Down here is the earth, the flesh, the darkness, all the lusts and desires that are out of control, unbridled. And he's saying, look, when you're doing these things that he's been telling us now for three chapters, this is not wisdom coming from above. This is stuff that's down from below. It's demonic, it's earthly, it's fleshly, right? We have the flesh and the spirit. The spirit is above, the flesh is below. We have all of these ways of saying the same thing with different pictures, whichever one works the best for you. Now, when he says it's demonic, ooh, it's demonic. All right, let's understand that correctly. Not demonic, meaning you're being influenced by. It means you're behaving like. Did I make that clear? When he says demonic, you're acting like a demon, meaning in rebellion and acting contrary actively to what Yahweh is trying to do. Not that you're being influenced by. Don't read this wrong. Don't go into that place. You're acting earthly, unspiritual, and like a demon would. So now you're acting in a role of demon instead of a role of a servant of Yah. Because where did the demons come from? Rebellion against Yah. And to strive and work against his efforts to do what he's doing. They're doing their efforts to go contrary to all of that. And so when you do these things, it's demonic. In other words, it's demon-like. I'm not saying that makes you a demon, but it's behavior like a demon would behave. For where jealousy and self-seeking are, verse 16, there is confusion in every foul deed. When you're jealous or self-seeking. Self-seeking, by the way, can come in any kind of form, not what you may all be going to some default, like it's an ego and outward expression. No, a lot of you are self-seeking by hiding, or you're self-seeking because it's about you not wanting to be seen or not wanting to ask questions or not wanting to be found out. Now, so it's not always a big open thing, this self-seeking, because some of you think of these loud, boastful people. Putting you first is self-seeking. I don't want to do this. I don't like that. I'd rather be by myself. I don't want to talk to Rabbi. I don't want to go do this. I don't want to go do that. That's self. And when you put self first, that's self-seeking. You're seeking to please you above what he's saying. So you're seeking the self and its desire over the Creator and his desire. You're pursuing. Don't think of that. Seeking may be a harder word to understand. You pursue through your behavior, your thoughts, and your actions. You're pursuing what self wants, not what he wants. All right? And jealousy, this is also, I think, connected back to verse 1 of this chapter when he talks about not becoming teachers. Sometimes people want to go into the teaching mode because they're jealous of other people being teachers, and I can teach. I don't need a teacher. I can go ahead and teach. And a lot of the people that reject teachers, there's a jealousy there too. And there's a self-seeking. You can't teach me anything. What makes you think you're so smart? Blah, blah, blah. Whatever it is. That whole negative talk that may be just going on in your head, it also may be coming out of your mouth. Because I've heard people talk to each other saying, oh, who does that guy think he is teaching? And he thinks that blah, 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 blah. All right. So it may come out of your mouth. That's that unbridled tongue. He says, where these things are, there is confusion. Where the self-seeking is, there's confusion. Absolutely, no doubt about it. And let's start with the first confusion. The first confusion is, who is supposed to be in charge? You or him? There's an authority confusion first and foremost. Because when you're seeking self, you're not putting him on the throne. So naturally, if the wrong authority is in your life, most of your life is going to end up in some level of confusion. And guess what else is going to happen? He says in the rest of the verse, every foul deed. Anything that you do that's a foul deed is going to come out of confusion. Not that everything you do wrong comes out of confusion, but we're talking about a foul deed, meaning I think it's considered more foul to him or abominable or whatever word it is when you're doing it, thinking and claiming and convincing yourself that it's what he wants. That's the confusion. Not confusion where I just don't know what to do. We're not talking about that kind of confusion. You're confusing him with you. You're confusing the voice in your head that's you as his voice. I've told you, you've got at least three voices in your head. I'm not trying to say you're crazy and you need to go get therapy. I'm saying you have three voices in your head. You've got the self, the ego, the you, that your own voice, I like, I want, I don't like, I don't want. You have Hasatan's voice, which basically is agreeing with you and encouraging you to use your voice, because all of the ideas come from you, not him. He's just a cheerleader. He's cheering you on, going, go for it, come on, do what you want. You don't need to listen to anybody else. And the third voice is the still small voice. There's that still small voice that's Yahweh's voice. And that voice is waiting for the other two to shut up, quite frankly. You got to quiet those. That's why meditation and prayer, by prayer I mean not actively saying anything, but being quiet is so important. Because then maybe you might allow the other voice to speak. I'm not saying you'll hear anything, but you might be inspired. That's the way the voice will speak to you. And you might see things in a different way than you ever saw them before, because the other voices have finally calmed down and gotten quiet. It's very hard to listen and hear directions. You know, we did a great thing one time with the children that we thought was a great exercise with one of the feast programs, where the child had to walk through an obstacle course a little bit and only turn based on the voice telling them which way to turn, while everybody else was kind of shouting and talking to them and saying other things. And they had to find a way to hear that one voice that's the only one they were supposed to listen to. And I think they had them blindfolded so they couldn't know what. They had to listen to a voice. Go to your left, go to your right, take two steps. Meanwhile, everybody else is like, no, turn right, no left, or this or that. Now, the difference when the children did it is the voice trying to talk to them wasn't whispering. I think that might have been a better way to do it. Have the person whispering that they're supposed to listen for through all the other noise. Very hard to do. He's saying, look, where these things are, there is confusion, and that confusion leads to you doing things, thinking it's him when it's not him. Lord, Lord, we did all these things in your name. And he said, no, but that wasn't what I wanted you to do. I know you did them in my name, but you were confused. You were confused. And so you did not do what I said. You did instead unrighteousness. Depart from me, you workers of unrighteousness. You did not keep my commandments. As a matter of fact, you were confused to think that I somehow sent my son to do away with them. And that does confuse a lot of people. And so therefore, they don't do the doing, because after all, it's been wiped out. And they believe that genuinely. I don't fault them. I mean, they genuinely have been told that. And they were told to believe what their pastors taught them and all the way down the road with all that, which is funny how they choose to submit to who they choose to submit to. And a part of it is because they like the idea of not having to do, even on an unconscious level. And that's why some of your friends and family members are very irritated with you, because if you're right, they have to change it. They do not want to switch all that stuff in their life about. They've already watched you do it, and they don't want to do it. They don't want to eat different, change the days they keep. They don't want to do all of these other things. The men certainly don't want to all of a sudden have to put, you know, tzitzit on and wear these in public. And, you know, what are people going to think? I'm wearing stuff on my clothes. I don't know what they're going to think, and I don't care. It's not relevant to my doing it. And that's another thing that I think every teacher out there, that's the life coaches, etc., that I've been listening to of late, just little clips here and there, they want to encourage everybody that they're training, this is worldly, okay, this is their, just to be successful in life, to stop caring what everybody thinks. You want to walk this out? You're going to have a really hard time if you care what everybody thinks. You are really going to have a hard time. That doesn't mean you have a callous disregard. I mean, I would like people to like what I'm doing. I would like people to approve, but I'm not going to allow what they think to influence my decisions. That's what I mean by caring. Don't allow them to influence what you're doing. And that's a lot of what's going on here in chapter 3. People teaching who shouldn't be teaching, teaching things they shouldn't be teaching, and not having a sense of the fact that that influence will be there. He's saying, be careful with that, because that's when we end up in confusion and every foul deed. Now, to tie it together, he goes to verse 17. He says, but the wisdom from above is first clean, then peaceable, gentle, ready to obey, filled with compassion and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. The people that are out there teaching who are not ready or not qualified, the people that are driven by self-seeking or self, you know, the desire for them, their things to be their way, I want things to be my way because I'm most comfortable when things are my way. Everybody's that way. Everybody's most comfortable when things are the way they like it to be. Much more comfortable. I mean, that's one of the challenges when people get married and the two end up in the same house and each one has a certain way. They like certain things in the house and they don't match. Well, guess what? That's going to be a real problem unless somebody wins out. And I would tell the men, let the wife win out on most of that, because unless it's a real issue that's got a real reason to be an issue, why wouldn't you lay down your life for her? Okay, I tell the guys all the time, nothing wrong with putting your foot down, but be really careful about when and that it be a real important reason. Okay, you don't need to put it down just to remind everybody who's in charge. That's a wrong motivation. Put it down because there's a real reason, and not a self-seeking reason. Well, but I don't like it when this kind of food is in that cabinet. I like them over in that cabinet. So adjust to it. I just want to know where it is. And even if I know where it is, I forget. And then my wife looks at me like, how do you not know where that is? I don't know. I don't remember anything is. Just answer the question, where is it? Because I get the look of like, how do you not know? Accept the reality, I don't know. Okay? Of course, ladies, if you decide something is better in a different place, tell your husband you moved it. Because we're going to go to the original place it was and be like, well, where'd it go? And then you look at us like, well, I moved it. Well, information would be good if you shared it, okay? So that I know that you moved it. I don't have a problem that you think it was a better idea. I don't care where it is. I just want to find it. And I'm very red, so if I can't find it and I need it right now, I get very frustrated. I get upset. Because something is slowing me down and it's not where I want it to be. Okay? Well, let's understand that we have to, as we go through this, understand that the wisdom from above is going to be peaceable and gentle and ready to obey him. Okay? Not ready to obey that voice inside of you or your neighbor or your friend or your family member or whoever it is. Okay? Ready to obey him. And by the way, that still works in the vertical. So obeying him may be a situation and a problem for you in working with a leader like myself. In other words, if you have a rabbi that you're working with, if there's a congregational leader and your submission to that, you have to figure out how that all works in the vertical. Ladies, how the husbands work. But also, if you are in the vertical, he's addressing you here. You have got to understand you're in the middle. You're always in the middle. There's only one knot in the middle. That's the Father. Everybody else, including Yeshua, is in the middle. They have to submit to an authority, and they're responsible for somebody. So if you are in the vertical, never take that in any way other than total humility as a servant, knowing that it's not an ego thing or a pride thing or a power thing. The higher up you are in the vertical, the more responsibility you have, not the more power you have. The more to lay down your life. Who did the most of that? The highest up the chain other than the Father. Yeshua laid down his life so that we could have life. And so that's the way that works, and we have to understand that. He says, look, it's done gentle, ready to obey, filled with compassion and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Again, we talk about the integrity versus hypocrisy problem. Okay? He says in verse 18, and the fruit of doing what's right, we call that righteousness, is sown in peace by those who make peace. It's sown in shalom, in those who make peace. But making peace doesn't mean give up your integrity and not walk in hypocrisy. But there's a way to make the effort to have peace. And that's important. That doesn't mean that you'll always do it perfectly, but when you don't, you have the opportunity to try to set it straight later. And I have done that. I just want to assure you, with a lot of the people that have had issues and conflicts, when I've had opportunity, I have tried to make peace. Not always successfully, sometimes, not always, but at least peace. Peace doesn't mean reconciliation, restoration, and everything else necessarily, but there can be peace. We can have a separation and have peace. Or we could have one that's ugly and violent. Okay? And so let's be careful with that. Then we get to chapter 4. So where do fightings and strivings come from among you? Do they not come from your pleasures that battle in your members? You desire and do not have. You murder and are jealous and are unable to obtain. You strive and fight, and you do not possess because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask evilly in order to spend it on your pleasures. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with Elohim? Whoever therefore intends to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of Elohim. Or do you think that the scripture speaks to no purpose? Does the spirit which dwells in us intensely crave unto envy? He gives greater favor because this he says, Elohim resists the proud but gives favor to the humble. So then subject yourselves to Elohim and resist Hasatan, resist the devil and he shall flee from you. Let's break this down a little bit. Where does these issues come from? We desire. Now it says these things, these pleasures that battle in us. And the battle didn't really exist until he woke you up. You had desires and you ran with them generally. You may have had some things that you were taught in culture or in the world that are right and wrong, so maybe there was a little bit of a battle. But once you came to know what right and wrong actually are, but you still desired some of the things that were wrong and didn't want some of the things that were right, there's a battle inside. And what happens is the battle is not being won by the right side. It's being won sometimes by the wrong side. The things, the below, the earthly, the fleshly is winning out from time to time over the above, the heavenly, the spiritual. He says, you desire and don't have. Oh, that bothers us big. I want it and I don't have it. I'm going to have no peace. I'm going to be upset. And then you know what? I may do something that goes against Torah to get it. I'm going to break something that he said not to do because I want it. I'm not even talking about something as straightforward as stealing it. I want to go to that wedding. I want to go to that graduation. I want to go to, but it's on Shabbat. I want to eat this thing. I love shrimp. Now, I never liked it, but I'm just saying, I know a lot of people have a thing for that or whatever it is. Well, you can't have it anymore, but you want it. So what are you going to do? Well, I want to be the teacher, but you're not the teacher. Well, I want to be a deacon, elder, whatever you want to be, but you're not. Is it going to bother you? Well, I came here and I thought Rabbi and I were going to be like best friends, and it didn't happen. So, I mean, you wanted it, but this is a real thing, by the way. We've had multiple people get mad and leave because they thought they were going to come here and become like best friends with me, and it didn't happen, and they left. I literally had one guy many years ago come, and he thought we'd be going out to lunch all the time and hanging out, and I don't think I got to see him at all the first 3-4 weeks he was here, and then he ended up leaving. I don't have but one best friend and a few people that I call close friends. I'm friendly to a lot of you, but I mean, I don't have that many people that I actively choose to spend time with, mostly because I don't have the time to do that. As a matter of fact, my best friend, when he was here last, asked Billy to go on my schedule so I could see him. That's not a joke. That happened. He wanted to be put on the counseling list just so I can hang out with him for a few minutes. And so just understand, I don't have that kind of capacity. But see, we want and we desire and we don't have, and that messes us up. Because we're still worldly, fleshly. We're still children. That's a very childish mindset. First of all, you were children, but if you don't remember that far back, if you've seen other children or had your own, you know what it's like when a child wants and they don't have. Life is wonderful in those moments, isn't it? And there's no peace anywhere. And they're going to disturb yours until you either shut it down somehow or give in. And unfortunately, most of the time you give in. And that only makes it worse because it shows them it works. My children never did that to me because I showed them right up front it wasn't going to work. Not in a bad way. I just made it clear it's not going to work. And so they never do that to me. I say no, that's it, they know. Because I told them, and if you ask again, whatever it is gonna get worse. If I took away your thing for a day, you ask me again, it's gonna be 3 days. Don't ask me for it until the time is over. Don't try to convince me to shorten the time. It is what it is. But you give in. You say, give me that thing, I'm taking it away from you. And less than an hour later, they've got it back. Really? Well, but I felt bad and blah, blah, blah. No, you're not feeling bad, you're encouraging bad. You're enabling bad. Don't do that. You have no integrity. You take things away, you tell them you're gonna punish them, then you don't go through with it. Don't say anything out of your mouth that you're not gonna fulfill, especially with your children. You say it, you mean it. You know why my children don't ever do that with me? Because they, when I say it, they know I mean it. So they don't have, there's no reason for them to go any further. That doesn't mean they do everything I say. I'm just saying, but if I say something, they know I mean it. Mom's got a little bit different heart. She's working on that. But that's mostly, moms have that more than the men do anyway, okay? They have a different connection. After all, they carried you for a lot of time. They gave birth to you and everything. They have a different connection. But I want to encourage you moms, say it and mean it. That's the best thing you can do with your children. If you don't mean it, don't say it. Because then they know and they'll figure it out very quickly. And now you've got yourself a problem because then when you do mean it, they're not going to believe it. Because you didn't mean it the last time. We want, we desire. And so then what happens? We take action. He says you murder, are jealous, and are unable to obtain. He's also saying you may take action, but you're still not going to get what you really want. You're still not able to obtain. You strive, you fight, you do not possess because you do not ask. You're not approaching it correctly by the do not ask. In other words, you're going about it here. You are going about it. You're not asking him how to go about it or asking him to help you and guide you in how to go about it. I'm not talking about the maybe Christianized way of just asking him to do it, but asking him how you should do it. Asking him to show you what to do and how to do it, where to do it, when to do it, and all that other stuff, and not just asking him to just do it. Now, you certainly could ask, and if it's something that I can't do, I really would appreciate if you would do it for me, because that's what he is there to do, the things you can't do. What he is not there to do is the things you won't do. So ask him. He's saying, look, you're not asking because you don't want to ask, because you don't want the answer he's going to give you, which may be no. Which is the same reason why you don't come talk to me. Because you already know, sometimes you already know what the answer is going to be and you don't want to hear it. Because you know once you hear it, you're responsible for what you heard. So you avoid that. That's just foolish, by the way. It doesn't change anything. It's like you have a cavity and your tooth is starting to fall apart and you think that not going to the dentist is going to fix it. No, the only way to fix it is to go have it treated and taken care of. You can't ignore it and think that somehow that fixes anything. Or you're going about it your own way. You got to be careful with all of that. He says, look, you ask and you do not receive because you ask evilly. In other words, you go about it the whole wrong way. You're asking it from a self-seeking, self-desire, I want, I don't have, me, me, me. Remember, evil is what? Anything that is not going in line with, that goes against the way he intended it to be. So you're asking for something that's not in line with the way he intended it to be. So he says, even when you ask evilly, in order to spend it on your pleasures. In other words, you're asking it for you, for self-seeking, for me, 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 me. And then he calls you adulterers and adulteresses. Why would he call you that? Did somebody go and have relations with someone not their spouse? He's saying it's a spiritual adultery here. You're now looking towards, in an authority way, one that's not your authority. In the husband-wife relationship we think of in terms of us being married to our Creator, that stuff he's supposed to be deciding. He has authority in, and when we usurp that, we're actually committing adultery because we're taking another authority in his place. So he calls them adulterers and adulteresses. Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity to Elohim? In other words, when you do things and are influenced by that from the below, that from the earthly, the worldly, the fleshly, all that is at odds with, it's an enemy towards Elohim. You know, we're told that when you were not, let me rephrase that. In Ephesians it says, when you were Gentiles, outside covenant, had no bubble pop, did not know what was going on, you were at enmity with your Elohim. You had no relationship. Now, you didn't do it on purpose. It was a default position he allowed you to be in until he opened up your heart and your mind to know that you were his enemy at that time. But you were outside of that relationship he calls covenant. He says, here, James is saying, you're in the same place when you give in to your fleshly desires, when you act friendly to the world. By friendly to the world, we're not talking about that you have friends who are in the world. We're talking about that you're embracing the world's ways and thoughts and actions. He says, whoever therefore intends to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of Elohim. He says, do you think that the scripture speaks to no purpose? Does the spirit which dwells in us intensely crave unto envy? You see, envy, this is the 10th commandment, coveting, right? We want, we seek, and we see, and we want. Well, why do they have that? I want that. Well, I don't know why he's got that. That's not fair. I want that. How come you get to have that? That's where the envy starts coming. And it sounds, sometimes it doesn't sound like that. It sounds more humble sounding, quote unquote. How come I don't get to have something? And why is it that I never get to win? And how come I just get to be? And it's this woe is me victim thing. So it's not so much an envy thing. It turns into a victim thing. And we've had a lot of people come through here playing the victim. And then they find a place where they love victims. And so they go over there. Okay? But you need to stop. You're not a victim. You should be an overcomer. You're going to be a victor. Not a victim, victor. In Yeshua, we have victory as a potential, not automatically, but we can have victory over all these things. We can overcome. Go listen to the teaching, to he who overcomes. And understand what overcoming is all about. Because everything you want, it says in Revelation, all of that is to the ones who overcome until the end. It says, to he who overcomes till the end shall receive all this. But don't be a victim and don't envy. So maybe you're not a victim, but you're just thinking, oh yeah, but I want that. That's where you start envying and desiring and having jealousy and craving. And you crave and you desire. And if it doesn't, by the way, that whole emotion is totally insatiable. You go ahead and grab whatever you need and you're still going to want more. You're never going to satisfy it. But you keep thinking, well, if I just have that. But you've done that before and you've gotten whatever that is and you still wanted more. That emotion cannot be satisfied. It can be bridled. It could be redirected. It could be disciplined. It could be controlled. It cannot be satiated. You cannot satiate that thought and emotional process. I want will always be something next. Once you get, you'll still want more. You want something else and you want more. There's no satisfying that. And you will always be miserable. That's why the Dayenu mindset, saying, I have. And if I get nothing more, it would be enough. Satisfies that desire. It's a different thought process and a different mindset of appreciating what you have that curbs the desire for more. Then there are things that you should want more of. You can choose to allow that desire, and you can choose which desires are going to be entertained and which ones are going to be shut down or bridled or controlled or disciplined. Because remember, it's your desire that's causing all the fighting, all the striving internally and with other people. Hopefully that makes sense. I'm going to go ahead and stop here and we'll finish with chapter 4 some more next time and we'll see what we get with that. because it's already an hour and 10 minutes in, so we're going to close here. Let's go ahead and close in prayer. Father, we come before you, and Father, we want to really and truly embrace our part in all of this, our part in our striving, in the dissension, in the fightings, in the things that are happening amongst us with our relationships and family and friends and within congregations, and understand where the desire ends up causing the problem, where we have these problems and issues with our thoughts and emotions not being bridled, so that then the tongue could be bridled. And so, Father, we do struggle with wants and desires. Help us to redirect those things to desiring only from you, only what is from above. Have us crave and desire the above in a right way, not in a jealous way, not in an envious way, but in a desire to please you. Let us desire out of wisdom, out of the fear of you, so that we can be desiring it so that we please you, not please ourselves. And that's really what we are learning here today, and we really need to embrace is that we do these things to seek our own pleasure instead of seeking your pleasure. Father, help us to seek your pleasure, to do what's pleasing in your sight that gives you pleasure. And we do that by loving you appropriately as you have instructed and by loving each other appropriately as you have instructed. So, Father, we thank you. And we praise you and ask again, as always, your patience and mercy and compassion on us as we struggle in this transformation and the idea of conforming and transforming the effort we make to become like Yeshua. So, Father, we want to thank you, praise you, and give you all glory and all honor in the name above all names, Yeshua, our Messiah. Amen. Amen.